Welcome to Leaders and Legends of Online Learning, a podcast dedicated to the experts. Thank you for listening. Each episode, we'll be learning from the world's leading thinkers and practitioners in online learning and linking to ideas relevant to online teaching, working with online learners, and digital education. You can listen to the experts and check their profiles and link to some of their work on our website, www.onlinelearninglegends.com. I'm Mark Nichols, the interviewer in this episode. You'll meet Associate Professor Michael Barber in this episode. Michael is a researcher of instructional design and online distance education for the K-12 sector, based at Touro University in California. His advocacy for and scholarship in online K-12 education demonstrated as a model whose time has come. I'm talking with Michael Barber, who is currently an Associate Professor of Instructional Design for the College of Education and Health Services at Touro University, California. Michael's career in instructional design includes several initiatives supporting online education in K-12 contexts. Michael, it's great to be talking with you.
Likewise, Mark.
Can we start with a brief overview of your career and publications?
I had the good fortune, or at the time when, you know, you're a fledgling doc student, it seemed like the misfortune, of being one of the first folks that were looking at the area of K-12 online learning. While K-12 distance learning had been around for, well, almost a century when I had started, and there had been a wealth of research into sort of the legacy models, correspondence, educational radio, telematics, and so forth. There were probably only five or six folks involved in K-12 online learning when I first started writing about it back in, I think I published my first article on it in like 99 or 98, maybe. Yep. I know that I first became aware of it in 97 when I was following a project that was going in my home province of Newfoundland that was actually being led by a fellow Kiwi, Ken Stevens, at the time. Mm-hmm. He was working at Memorial University. And really, it's been sort of the sole or singular focus of my academic work. So all throughout my doctoral degree, and I was fortunate to go to a university that focused primarily upon training folks that were going to end up in research universities. They essentially wanted to train folks that would look like them at the University of Georgia. And so I had the opportunity to do a lot of writing back then. In fact, one of the articles that I published out of my dissertation is still my most cited article. It was a literature review that was published back in 2009 by Computers in Education. Yeah. I spent 6 years at Wayne State University and continued to work in this area. And while I was there, I was fortunate that the Michigan, where Wayne State was located, was the first state in the U.S. that actually required students to have an online learning experience in order to graduate from high school. So it put an additional focus upon the work that I was doing and provided a lot of opportunity to engage with practitioners in that research. You know, and then a few years at Sacred Heart in the Northeast in Connecticut. And I've been, I'm in my sixth year now at Touro University here in California. And like many people in the field over the last couple of years, I've really been focused upon looking at what's been happening in terms of the use of distance learning as a means to provide some sort of continuity of learning for students, and how we can sort of distinguish this emergency remote learning that we saw initially, and then some of the planned, or in some cases unplanned, remote learning that's been taking place, and how that's different from these traditional online learning programs that we've been looking at for the last three decades.
Can I unpick that a little bit with you, Michael? So you've used online and distance almost as synonyms, and then you've also injected emergency remote teaching. Can you talk a bit about the relationship across those things?
Certainly. So online learning for me is basically a type of distance learning. So distance learning, I think, is more of an all-encompassing term, if you will. Online just refers to the specific distance medium that we're using at the moment, or that's, I guess, the majority at the moment. And I say the majority at the moment because it's actually quite fascinating that over the past 2 years, as the pandemic has unfolded, the jurisdictions that were able to rely the least or rely less on online forms of distance education, those that still had robust what we would call legacy mediums. New Zealand is actually a great example of this. You've got the correspondence school down there, Te Kura, that has been operating now for, I think this year is actually its 100th anniversary. And the ability for that to fill in the gaps that we've seen around the digital divide has really allowed New Zealand to be, in my opinion, one of the leaders in terms of the remote learning that's happening. And that's the third term you asked about, that emergency remote or remote learning. And the main difference, I think, between that and a traditional or established distance or online learning program is the idea that remote learning is designed to be temporary in nature. So it's what we do when we can't have folks in the classroom, but as soon as we can bring them back to an in-person context, we plan on doing that. Mm-hmm. Now, that doesn't mean that there aren't online learning programs that are operating right now. So the virtual learning networks in New Zealand and the DISA, the Te Kura, all of the online schools that we have here in North America, those weren't providing remote learning. They were providing online learning throughout the pandemic because they had every intention of, regardless of what was happening with COVID-19 and the local epidemiology of the pandemic, students were going to be online anyway. That was the plan. Whereas in a remote learning, they might be in the classroom 1 week, and then next week, two-thirds of the class has tested positive. So we have to move to a distance for a short period of time. But once that's over, we're going to come back to the classroom. And that's more of a remote learning context.
Okay, so your publications span around about two decades. Can you give us some insight as to the ideas and themes your work has provided, particularly those themes that you sense are still pertinent today?
Being one of the early folks in the field, one of the nice things about that was because there hadn't been a lot of work done specifically in this area, I could write about all sorts of aspects from, you know, how do we design online, asynchronous online content specifically for non-adult learners or adolescent learners, learners that don't have that self-directed, self-regulated nature. How do we deliver and facilitate those courses? And how is that different than, say, what we do in the tertiary environment or in the corporate sector? How do we prepare teachers to be able to design that content, deliver that content, facilitate that content, both in terms of their initial teacher preparation that they would go through as part of their university experience, but also professional development that's needed? How do we prepare students to learn in this environment? What sort of regulatory and policy regimes do we need to put in place to allow for the growth of these programs, but in a way in which that it grows in a responsible way? I would say that the vast majority of my work in the first 10 to 15 years focused specifically upon how do we design, deliver, and support online learning for a K-12 audience. It sort of shifted about 10 years ago. While I was still doing a bit of work in that area, I really started looking more at the regulatory and governance structures that were in place. What legislation needs to be in place so that these systems can develop in responsible ways, as opposed to some of the predatory and profit-driven ways we've seen here in North America. And then I guess like most folks, the past 2 years have been largely focused upon what's been happening in the pandemic. So I can sort of think about it in those kind of three themes, if you will.
Yeah. So broadly speaking, what are the things that actually work in online K-12 education? Are there particular things you could just quickly snatch out, the things that perhaps might be surprising or the things that make the most difference in terms of an effective K-12 online learning experience or system?
One of the things that I think is I've seen happen a lot, but doesn't happen as much as I would hope. Particularly here in North America, you see a lot of these online programs, regardless if they're for-profit or not-for-profit programs, they talk a lot about individualized instruction and personalized learning, those types of things. But the reality of it is that they have courses that are designed in one manner, and they're delivered in one manner and supported in one manner. Mm-hmm. And really the only individualization is oftentimes the amount of that content you have to cover, depending on what you already know and what you don't know. Yeah. And then the amount of support that you demand of the online program. The ones that I've seen that have had real success, and I think this speaks to, you know, what we've seen in the research, is you'll find oftentimes that a school or a school district or a regional authority will look at a specific group of students that aren't being served in the traditional public education system.
Yeah.
And they'll look at it and say, okay, now what kind of program can we put in place that will allow these students to have success? And, you know, so how do we set up the courses in a way that will allow them to have success? Mm-hmm. How do we mm-hmm. deliver those courses? What kinds of supports do those folks need? What kind of training do both the teachers need, but also sort of an orientation for the students? And the answers to those questions will look very different from, you know, student to student. You know, I've seen programs that, because of looking at those questions, instead of having students take the 4 or 5 courses at a time that, you know, a regular student in the classroom would take, they'll have the students only focus upon a single course or maybe 2 courses. And yeah. they'll basically just do that one class. And then once they finish that class, which in theory is going to should take a quarter or a fifth of the semester of the year, then they move on to the next one. Online programs where there is some residential component, where students actually have to go to a physical site for certain periods of time, but having the day for them look very different than our traditional sort of 8 to 3 or 9 to 3 school day. You know, so starting with those questions, I think, is really what we've seen in the research, because what that looks like for a child of a single parent who has younger siblings that, you know, they've got to work to try to support those, or looks very different than from someone who is in an online course because they've already failed, you know, their grade 9 maths 2 or 3 times, and, you know, they're looking for a different option compared to somebody who is taking an online program because they want to finish their 4 years of high school in 3 years.
Yeah. So there's quite a breadth of student need out there. I think it's especially when you stop looking at schools as highly structured environments, I guess the online world provides a lot more flexibility and the ability to be more accessible to a broader range of students.
Definitely. But I think the one thing that I think online learning can provide that I don't think people talk enough about, but the research certainly bears this out. You talk about school being a single structure. Well, if you can envision school being, say, 8 different structures or 10 different structures. Mm. And depending upon the demographic or individual needs of a group of students, you put them into one of these 8 or one of these 10 programs, so that each of the programs are delivered in slightly different ways, but they're fairly standardized in terms of for all of the other students. So if we could get all of those like students into an environment that's specifically suited for them, as opposed to putting all students into, you know, the one environment, or the rhetoric that we have now about making online learning something that is completely individualized to the student. Because I think that, right. In all honesty, well, I use the term rhetoric very specifically around that.
Absolutely. So, Michael, it's early 2022. We've already mentioned COVID. I mean, it's hard to get away from. What are your observations about online learning and education at the present time, perhaps with a particular focus on the K-12 context?
Yeah, so actually, it's interesting. I'm having a conversation with a couple of folks in an email thread that that we've been having over the past few days that looks at this idea of where we are now and looking at a lot of the media items that are coming out. And one of my colleagues used the term, you know, well, this looks like remote learning. And we know that remote learning has been shown to be quite terrible. And, you know, we're in our third school year now that's being impacted by the pandemic. While it wasn't totally unforeseen, particularly in some jurisdictions, it was okay that I think, or at least acceptable, forgivable, if you will, that some folks got, you know, blindsided by what happened in March of 2020. There were some signs to it, and some jurisdictions were a lot better prepared for it than others. But once we got to the 2020 and 21 school years, it really started to become inexcusable for school leaders not to prepare for future disruptions. And now that we're into a third school year, in all honesty, the school leaders that haven't prepared for what happens if I have to, you know, close the school for 2 or 3 or 4 weeks, what happens if half of my grade three class or my year nine class are out for the next month, what happens if all of my, kindergarten or year 11 teachers are out sick. We're at a point now where remote learning and using that term, I think, is just an excuse to give folks a pass for the fact that they just haven't planned and they haven't looked at what we know about online learning and how to design and develop and support it in effective ways. So as I look at where we are now, I actually have a great deal of disappointment around the current situation and a great deal of dread might be too strong a word, but a great deal of pessimism, I guess, about what's likely to come in post-pandemic. You know, because the reality is, I think a lot of folks haven't had a good experience with distance education over the past couple of years. And like I say, while that was excusable right at the beginning, we're at the point now where we should be out of excuses if we're being intellectually honest with ourselves. Historically, pandemics have tended to happen once to three times a century. We're in 2022 now, and this is the fifth global pandemic we've experienced this century. So the reality is that the need to be able to shift the system to some form of remote or distance learning for, it could be days, it could be weeks or months, depending upon what it is that's driving the disruption. Is going to have to become the default position for schools. I mean, the reality is this is becoming more and more frequent, and it's something that needs to happen. And even thinking beyond just natural disasters and global pandemics and those types of things, think about just the kid that gets. That just falls ill for 2 or 3 days. The ability to be able to provide continued learning to them other than just, telling them to read a few chapters in the textbook and you'll get caught up when you get back home. More and more, we're seeing folks that are involved in a global economy where not only does one of the parents, or both parents for that matter, have the ability to, do work from really anywhere. Right now, we're not able to leverage that in the way that we could simply because we've got to keep our kid in a brick and mortar school. So I think the first thing that we need to do around this is we need to move off of that idea that the classroom is the default. Even if that's where we want the student to be most of the time, I think we need to come to the understanding that we're going to need more and more of these options, and we're going to have to use them more frequently. There's a blogger here in the U.S., a gentleman by the name of Brian Alexander, used the term toggle semester. And he was talking about it from a higher ed context. So the idea was essentially that you could have a student that was in a face-to-face environment, on Friday when they left school, and then over the weekend, it was decided that they needed to move to a distance format for Monday, and that the quality and level and access to the instruction come Monday was the exact same as it was on Friday when they were in the classroom. For him, that's sort of how he envisioned this toggle semester or this toggle term, the fact that, the system, regardless if it was, the fact that the kids had devices and had access to that learning and the educators that were delivering that instruction, regardless if it was in a face-to-face or a distance environment, and even the students, because that's the part we often overlook, And, you know, they were prepared to know how to learn in either environment. And then the aspect that's always completely overlooked is the parents and their ability to help support their kids in this environment. Because I think you've asked a couple of times about specifically in the K-12 environment. And I think that's actually one of the biggest differences between the K-12 environment and other environments is that we have the parents or the family that's a sort of a key player in this. And while most parents have some understanding of what a classroom experience looks like, oftentimes because they, you know, sat through it for 13 years, most of them don't have that sort of that schema of what does an effective online learning environment look like, and what's my role in that environment in terms of what I'm supposed to do. So during the pandemic, we've seen parents that have literally sat in on every single lesson that the teacher has delivered when it's been done remotely, particularly here in North America, when we've had a lot of that synchronous instruction that's taken place. So trying to make sure that we know what they need to be doing and what their responsibilities are, I think, is a key aspect in as we look forward as well.
So, Michael, a question I've been really looking forward to, the research you'd most like to see, what gap out there do you think needs to be filled at the moment with a really effective study?
When I look at the system right now, I think the biggest deficiency I see, not just in the research, but in the practice as well, is how do we really effectively prepare teachers for either of these environments? And when we look at teacher education right now, while you can quibble about some of the aspects of it, I think as a society, we do a reasonable job at preparing professionals to go into a classroom face-to-face in-person environment and to do a reasonable job in that kind of setting. We've really never done well when it comes to how do we add technology to that aspect. And it's not just a formatting thing. If you go back to the 1980s and look at when we first started bringing these technology integration courses into teacher education, there was one of two models that was generally used. The first was that there was a standalone course often called, you know, integrating technology into teaching or teaching with technology or something like that.
Yeah.
And, you know, it was presented as something that was devoid of everything else. So it was completely isolated, completely separated from. And unfortunately, we spent so much time in that class focused upon how to use the technology as opposed to how to teach with the technology or how to facilitate learning with that technology.
Yeah.
The other model that we used back in the 80s was we basically said that, okay, we're going to try to make technology integration pervasive throughout the entire curriculum. Yeah. But the reality was, and still is, to be perfectly honest with you, that so many university faculty don't feel comfortable with the use of technology themselves. So in those let's make this pervasive throughout the curriculum, it's really a crapshoot, if you will, as to what professor you get in terms of, you know, how much they do that and how apparent they make it or obvious they make it to the students so that it can be used as a teaching model. And while I said it started back in the 80s, in all honesty, if you walk into the vast majority of teacher preparation programs really worldwide now, those two models that I just described still exist. You know, there are still, I'm going to say at least half, probably closer to two-thirds of university programs that have some kind of, you know, teaching with technology course in them. The other third to a half try to make the argument that they, and, you know, they might not say technology now, they might say that, you know, it's blended learning or online learning or something, you know, digital learning or what have you. They'll use different terminologies for it, but that it's included throughout their curriculum. And we're still doing a very bad job at both. So, and until we can fix that aspect of it, you know, if teachers are coming into the system thinking that this is an add-on, thinking that this is something that's isolated, that's oftentimes an elective as part of their course, that means that it's not a core part of the system. And, you know, that idea of changing that mindset from in-person being the default to, you know, the default being that location is irrelevant and it's the tools that we're using depending upon the location. We've got to, you know, change that mindset first. And then once we change that mindset, then those folks have to have the skills and the knowledge to be able to support the tools that they're using and then understand how to sequence or deliver instruction and facilitate with that with their students in an effective way. To me, that's the key thing. There's always been, I think, a hope, even beginning when these technology integration courses started being adopted in the 80s, that, well, they're only going to need to be short term because the next generation, they'll know how to use technology. And you hear the same thing now with digital learning, that there's this myth that, you know, because they have grown up in a society that's pervasive with technology, that somehow they'll know how to use it in effective and efficient ways for learning. Yeah. And seeing that just not bear out generation after generation now, to me, that's the research I'd like to see, because we've done a really bad job of this kind of thing now for 40 years.
Yeah.
So we need to find a better model.
Right. And of course, you touched on the myth of the digital native there as well.
There's a gentleman by the name of Steve Wheeler that actually he was writing about it in terms of learning styles. But I've always thought that in this particular article that I saw of his, if you replace the word learning styles with digital learner or digital native, the article still would have hung true. They talked about it being an inconvenient untruth. Yeah, the idea that, you know, it kind of intuitively makes sense, so most people will agree with it. But when you actually look at it, it doesn't hold water when it comes to the actual reality of the context. So the myth of the digital native really has hindered us in that respect.
So, Michael, just to close, two people you'd recommend as leaders or legends of online learning, one whose work or perspective is significantly influencing you, and one who you think otherwise has an important perspective to share.
I guess the first one I would point to is an old colleague of mine, actually someone who I still engage with in discussions and email and otherwise on a regular basis, who I know has influenced me a lot, is Ray Rose. Ray was involved with the creation of the virtual high school that was created back in 96. So it was one of the first online programs in the U.S. That and the Florida Virtual School were part of the first two supplemental programs in the U.S. He's worked in and out of the academy, but mostly in untraditional roles, spends most of his days these days being a consultant. He has a great focus upon special education and making sure that distance learning in general is accessible to all learners. He also plays the role of provocateur quite well. So if you're looking for someone to challenge your thinking, Ray is really a guy for that. The other one that I'd point to is actually a newer scholar, someone who I've seen develop from being a doctoral student at the Brigham Young University to a faculty member now at George Mason, and that's Jared Borup. And the reason I recommend Jared is because one of the limitations of the field of distance learning in general, regardless if, you know, of medium, regardless of K-12 or higher ed, is the fact that we haven't had a lot of theory or conceptual frameworks that have really been pervasive in the field. If you look at it, it wasn't until the 60s, 70s that we saw, even with the broader field of distance education, that we saw the development of really any theory. As it stands right now, there, up until a couple of years ago, there hadn't been any theory or conceptual frameworks that had specifically focused upon K-12 environment. That changed with Jared's work. He had been sort of doing this line of inquiry, and as a part of that work, developed this academic communities of engagement framework, or this ACE framework. The hallmark of a good learning theory is the fact that it isn't context dependent. So while it came out of the online learning environment, and I think is very useful in that environment, I think it can also be used in a face-to-face setting, both in the K-12 and in the adult population. But Jared Borup at George Mason University would be the second one that I would recommend for that very reason. I'm always anxious to see what the next development that he's going to have as he works through with this theory. I know they've just rebranded some of the variables, and actually even the name Academic Communities of Engagement is new in their latest version. And I know the next step that he wants to be working on is coming up now with an instrument that's designed to measure some of the variables that are in that framework. So it's exciting work to see, and ones that I'd encourage folks to follow, because I think it holds great promise for the field.
Brilliant. Michael, it's been fantastic catching up. Thank you so much for your time and interview. Thank you for being a leader of online learning.
And thank you for the conversation. It's been fun.
Thanks, Michael. You can learn more about Michael and his work from our website. That concludes this episode. Be sure to go to our website, www.onlinelearninglegends.com, to follow up on this episode's guest. You'll also find links to others whose ideas continue to inspire and teach online learning professionals, and you can subscribe to future interviews. If you know of a leader or legend we've not yet talked to, please do drop us a line at onlinelearninglegends@gmail.com.